In my heart of hearts, I feel like as nursing leaders, we ought to continue to advocate for nurses to be at the core of that communication. No other discipline spends as much time with patients. We need to continue to own that space, but importantly, to integrate it in all aspects of the work that we do. So to me, the difficult conversations, when I think of that in my current role, is with leadership. To promote the role that nurses play, to have those conversations.
Welcome to Season 2 of Radical Nurse Talk, a podcast that explores nurses' communication in serious illness and health-related situations as a radical act of care. I'm your host, Patricia Strachan. How can nurses be involved in decisions that patients make about innovative heart valve interventions for which they may be eligible? In this episode, Dr. Sandra Lauck thoughtfully describes her work and that of others in supporting nurses to have opportunities and language that opens spaces for patients to question, understand, and consider possible therapies. In this way, she offers radical possibilities for all nurses to transform patient experience not only in cardiac care, but in any practice setting. Dr. Sandra Lauck holds the St. Paul's Hospital Professorship in Cardiovascular Nursing at the University of British Columbia. She's an associate professor at the UBC School of Nursing and UBC Knowledge Exchange and Mobilization Scholar. She has a joint appointment as clinician scientist at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver and senior clinical nurse specialist lead at Providence Healthcare. Sandra leads a program of research that has focused on improving outcomes and experiences of people with cardiovascular disease, optimizing their care processes and delivery models to accelerate the uptake of contemporary evidence and the advancement of nursing practice. You will hear her commitment to linking clinical practice, policy, and scholarship through active engagement with patients, families, clinicians, and government organizations in all aspects of her research program. Thank you, Sandra, for talking with me today around an area that is kind of a mystery to lots of nurses and maybe patients, but this idea about shared decision-making, and then how does that weave into work with patients who are living with advanced illness? So I'm wondering if we, as we begin, if you can describe, give us a little background about your practice or your research focus with regards to this.
Yeah, thanks, Pat, and thanks for inviting me to this exceptional series. I'm honored to be here. I grew up in nursing at St. Paul's Hospital. Many of you will know that it's the downtown hospital of Vancouver. And I worked for most of my career kind of in that space between the curtain and the stretcher in the intensive care unit, and worked many a night shift, had many a moments walking alongside patients and families in some of the toughest days of their lives. And I think those were really my formative years as a nurse. Also grew up in an organization that really believes in social justice at the bedside. St. Paul's is highly committed to changing the world a little bit, or to trying to make things a little bit better for people as we care for them. And I should say that I'm coming to you on the unceded territories here of the Coast Salish people, the Musqueam, the Tsleil-Waututh, and the Squamish people. And that is another, I think, component of my learning as a nurse, walking and learning to do better. I transitioned from being at that bedside in critical care to being what I call a little bit of a late bloomer. I went back to grad school after four children and many adventures, and had the opportunity then in 2013 to complete my PhD. And I specifically looked at what do people need to know in this sphere of cardiovascular disease when they're making a decision to have an implantable cardioverter defibrillator. And I learned through that research that the integration of patients' perspectives is absolutely crucial to the work that we do and must be woven in to policy, to research, and to practice. So that, I think, was a missing piece of my puzzle as I tried to figure out how to be the most effective nurse I could be. And then in 2017, I was very fortunate to be appointed to a unique position. So appointed by University of British Columbia School of Nursing, but embedded at St. Paul's Hospital as a nurse clinician scientist. So I live most of my life in clinical care, and my research is, I would describe it as very practice close. It's an open door research program. So some days I don't get a lot done because my door is open to many a conversations of nurses coming by and talking about things that are happening in clinical care. And then my role as a scientist is to, again, walk alongside nurses to lift our discipline, to help nurses answer important questions that matter in the moment. So when you ask about, that's my long-winded answer to what is my program of research, it really is around knowledge exchange and mobilization. It is about promoting the role that especially cardiovascular nurses play in the sphere of not only using evidence, but producing evidence. And then importantly, it's about integrating patients' perspectives of care in the work that we do.
Okay, thank you. What amazing role modeling that is. How inspiring that must be for nurses and for patients that you work with. So we're going to dig into that a little bit. You have led work in integrating a palliative approach into a particular cardiovascular practice for nurses. Can you talk about that? What is that? How did that come to be?
You know, when I reflect back, I came to that thinking and that research kind of through the back door. So I was a clinical nurse specialist in an era of incredible innovation in the management of valvular heart disease, where there was really a shift in the way we treat heart valve disease. So really going from the golden practice of open heart surgery to being able to offer a more minimally invasive procedure through using a catheter. So here was a big medical innovation marching forward. At the time, case selection was crucial to, and still remains, to ensuring that patients would truly benefit, not just in terms of survival, but also in terms of quality of life. And I was doing a lot of work around the measurement of quality of life in patients undergoing transcatheter heart valve procedures. And bringing that to policymakers to say this was very important as well. It wasn't just survival up to 2 or 3 years. It was, what was the benefit? Through this, and I think through my clinical practice, I really came to understand that the decisions to be made for patients was not so much, should we have surgery or should we have a transcatheter approach? But in many cases, actually, especially in the early era of innovation, patients were anatomically ineligible for the procedure. So they would travel from northern British Columbia, undergo a couple of days of testing. We would look at all these images, look at all our consultations, and the heart team would then say, we cannot do this. So there were those questions of, can we do it? Should we do it? And is there any reason we should not do it? And again, very fortunate to work in a highly multidisciplinary team where nurses were are considered to be really key members of the heart team, and being able to voice some of those nursing assessments about, you know, our nurses were meeting patients and trying to understand what might be their motivation to undergo the procedure. And ranging, of course, from, you know, I just want to, the valvular heart disease affects mostly the older elder. So hearing these stories about, I could have heart surgery, for example, but my husband has dementia, and if I am out of commission for 3 to 4 months, this is going to tip him over into a care home. Or something like, I just want to be at my granddaughter's graduation next year. or I don't mind dying, but I can't live with these symptoms. But out of this as well, for this group of patients who had this hope of having a procedure that could be life-saving, but were ineligible, we kind of came up against the wall of, now what? You know, they would get the phone call from the nurse to say, you know, we reviewed your case. Unfortunately, we are unable to offer you an intervention. And for some patients, it was like falling off the cliff, because all they had heard about is, oh, there's this new procedure. You might be eligible for it, which they might have heard of, I am eligible for it. And now to hear, well, no, actually, there's nothing we can do for you. And I think it's something we do incredibly poorly in healthcare. And it's especially in these highly specialized programs, such as cardiology programs, is first of all, have those early conversations of this may or may not be for you. Regardless, you have a life-limiting disease, and let's have those conversations. So, you know, I think I felt, to tell you the truth, a little bit of distress around this, that we were promoting this innovation, and I was busy as a CNS building a program to ensure access and quality to this exceptional program. And then there was this group of patients who were kind of being discarded off the program. And I think this is where I really started to have some really incredible conversations with people like yourselves, Pat, who understand how to weave a palliative approach into a program, and embarked on some really interesting collaborations with my nursing and physician colleagues, and moved the program to have, at that point, a systematic and standardized process to then link people to a group of people who could help them manage their symptoms. And we did simple things as, you know, I think of my colleague Ella Garland, who was a nurse I worked with very closely and who really taught me a lot about the kind of language we can use, about a checklist we could use internally in our clinic to be able to, again, support continuity of care, but also transform the language we were using for some of these patients and reduce the risk of harm. So it has been, you know, to some degree, a little bit of a side project in the work that I was initially doing, but it became woven into some of the fabric of our clinical processes. And I don't want to paint a perfect picture here, because we have failed, we have messed up, but we have tried. And we have most importantly learned about putting those components, for example, in our patient education resources, so that it is not just, this is what we plan to do for you, but also some language around, you have a life-limiting disease. At some point, it becomes about symptom management, and we will support you to have access to that. So again, you know, I think one of my themes is this journey of learning around what is it that patients need, especially in the face of the introduction of substantial innovation. We can't be paddling in different directions. If innovation is going one way and what patients need is going another way, I think this is where nursing expertise shines, to actually advocate for, let's try to shift things a little bit so that we are paddling in the same direction. And the direction is, what matters most to patients? And that is increasingly the clarity I have about what the discipline of nursing can bring to the implementation of innovation, for example.
You have described so many things that I'd love to delve into here. I'm just going to clarify, a CNS is a clinical nurse specialist. And the other thing is, can you just give us a very brief description around what kinds of symptoms would these patients that you're talking about, who require, whose heart valves are not functioning well and require this kind of innovation you're talking about, what would their life be like living with that?
Yeah, what a great question. And I think back to one of our first patients who was You know how we as nurses will remember some really index patients, let's say. And I remember speaking with her. She was 92. She had had a very rich life. She had been involved in city politics. She had been pivotal in building a wilderness camp. She was a force to be reckoned with, although she was, you know, all of 5 foot something. And when I spoke with her, she talked to me about the symptoms of heart valve disease. And she talked about, I remember her saying, it's like I'm dying a little bit more every day. And that is because the primary symptom is that the garden hose, that aortic valve, just becomes tighter and tighter and tighter. And so it's a trickle of blood that comes out of the heart. And when that happens, well, clearly the fatigue that people feel over time can be devastating. And there is a triad of symptoms. One is people start feeling maybe a little bit, they feel faint. So they have syncope or presyncope. And it's really because that garden hose is too tight and there's not enough blood flowing up to the head. The second thing they can get is chest pain. Again, not enough blood coming out to the heart muscle and feeling that pain from low oxygen supplies. And the third is heart failure, because as the heart tries to overcome this pressure, it goes into failure because it's just working way too hard for too little output. So like hypertension, heart valve disease, especially aortic stenosis, is a silent disease. That buildup of calcium on the valve happens over a long period of time. And as I said, it's primarily a disease of the aging, but some younger people can get it as well. There is no medication to treat this. The only treatment is valve replacement. And then once patients develop those symptoms, most people, the mortality is within somewhere between 2 to 3 years. So it not only has a high burden of symptoms, but it's got a terrible prognosis in the absence of treatment. Because it's associated with getting older, sometimes patients would say to me, well, you know, I just feel tired because I'm getting older. But looking at their echo, for example, you know, they're getting tired because there is the heart valve space has reduced down by 50%, sometimes 70% to some critical components. So as a nurse involved in patient education, it's been interesting to try to tease out with patients, you know, the manage their expectations too, but also say, actually, one of the main reasons you are so tired is because of your tight valve. But what happens then over the course of their journey, of course, is hospital readmission, just feeling a little bit worse over time. It's been very rewarding to speak to people after a successful valve procedure. And all of a sudden there is, you know, perfusion. And perfusion is a beautiful thing, because all of a sudden you're going to the bathroom better. You are being able to look after your grandchildren. You're able to travel a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You're able to do the things that matter most to you. This is not the fountain of youth, but it is a way to manage those symptoms.
Okay, thank you. Can we go back to the comment that you made about your colleague teaching you about language? So the language that I think you called it transformative or transformational, and how that might be different from the language, or maybe it's in parallel to the language of innovation and treatment. You talk about the tensions that need to be, met, dealt with in talking. So would you be able to give us some language that maybe would be helpful in terms of others to use in speaking in similar situations?
Yeah, what an interesting insight, Pat. I think there's a few perspectives. I think there's for us as nurses and teams working the silos of care. I'm searching a little bit for a good answer to give to you, because I think it is reminding ourselves of the impact that we have when we speak with patients. And we know a lot about this, right? The impact of difficult conversations, the impact of failing to have conversations. So I think, again, and you refer to my role as a clinical nurse specialist, and those who may not be familiar with this role, so this is an advanced practice nursing role. So there are two roles in Canada, nurse practitioner and the clinical nurse specialist. And my role is really around the, or was at that point, around the advancement of nursing practice. It was about systems leadership, integrating research and knowledge translation, and importantly, leading clinical care. So in that role, you don't have a lot of power, but you have a lot of influence. And it is around that close relationship with nursing to role model some of these things. And as you know, there are many clinics that are absolutely overcome with busyness. And, you know, it's about queuing patients, it's about getting people in and out. And what the privilege I had at that time as a CNS was to bring nurses together to discuss some of these cases and for us to find those words, because nurses are always often the ones on the phone. So I think some of the language that we started to use was more tentative. You know, we received your referral. We understand that you've got heart valve disease. How are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. We integrated this concept of asking patients up front, what are you hoping to gain from this procedure? And that is such a powerful question when you ask patients, what are their needs and their, because it tells you, first of all, what do they know about the referral process, but it also gives you a sense of their goals of care. And it was an early attempt to align goals of care with looking at case selection. So I think that my first recommendation was, what are you hoping to gain from? Because I think those are really good words. The second recommendation is around tentative language, using things like, we're exploring if we may be able to offer you that. If we cannot, then making sure that you're conveying that this is a multi-factor decision-making process here, and it's not cookie cutter. And what we're doing is trying to figure out the best option for you. And then this builds into the work that I'm doing around shared decision-making, is then advocating for what matters most to patients. And I think that's my third recommendation, to integrate nurses in some of these team decisions. You know, we talk in cardiology, we talk about the heart team. You know, in oncology, talk about tumor boards, or, you know, all of these discussions that are around complex case management. And I have heard the power of my nurse colleagues speak to the team about why we may consider. I'm thinking of a case, for example, where the physicians felt like, you know, the patient ought to have surgery because that might be better, or the patient ought to have nothing. And the nurse able to say, actually, what I learned from this patient is that they not have surgery, because I mentioned that one before about their caregiver responsibility for spouses, for example. That has definitely happened a few times in my experience. But also saying, you know, maybe the patient is 92 and is, but lives independently, is very robust. The nurses, for example, advocated for the inclusion of a objective measurement of frailty, because age is just a number, and understanding there were ageist perspectives as well. So I think that third piece around using nursing expertise to have some of that language about what matters most to patients.
Thank you for that. We need, I think, to be shining a light on what is possible when nurses actually can work in those ways. Can we pick up on something you've referred to a couple of times about nurses on the phone with patients? So nurses are often put in positions that patients may feel more comfortable, or just because of the systems of care, that they're in positions where they're speaking with patients on the phone and things come up. And so you don't have a team around you physically. So Do you do any training around that? Or maybe you've talked a little bit about some of those things that nurses will say. How is it for nurses talking with patients on the phone about these things? Have they given you feedback?
You know, it's interesting because my office is right across the clinic where I hear my nursing colleagues speak with patients. And I am again and again and again struck by the excellence of nursing communication when it's done well. I hear some of my colleagues just spend the time trying to understand, you know, they'll say things like, so what's bothering you today? Or things like, let me just go over this again and use different language to explain the same thing. And often hearing them speak in ways that I don't think I would ever have that degree of competency, because it's a, as you said, it's a practice skill. Having said that, I think we all know that we're in this tsunami of human resource crisis in nursing, and we are in an era of, there's a lot of novice nurses out there who are extraordinary, and you're involved in training some of the best in the country, or educating the best in the country, and we have to somehow figure out how to almost do it in reverse now. In the case of the setting where I work, I'm very lucky to work with extremely experienced nurses who have been there for a long time and who have heard it all. And they are, they have a very high skill set. I don't know how to teach that other than co-locating people in an office and ensuring that people hear each other, because there is clearly a science to it. And, you know, that is relational practice. It is the principles of patient education and good communication. It is, you know, compassionate care, like the things that I think define the discipline of nursing. But it is also the art of active listening. It is the art of empathy. And at the end of the day, it's the art of clarity, to make sure that we manage expectations, but also that we convey really important information. So I wish I had a good answer to your question. I don't, but I think that is a real opportunity for us to shine a light in an area where, to me, nurses excel in that complex communication sphere. And it's prompting me to think about what can we do about that, about, you know, keeping almost some of that that oral history of how nurses interact with patients in a good way.
Yeah, it's so interesting, because I think so often we're looking at, and I know checklists have their place, but scripts and checklists, and yet so much of what we're doing, we can go in with the biggest plan, and then what do you do with what you get back? And, you know, how do we honor that and make it about patients? And a lot of what I'm hearing you say is around really focusing on where people are at and not where we're at or necessarily where we want them to be, and to really be much more holistic. It's not just about a procedure.
You're right that in these moments where you're trying to, like, this is something that nurses do. They try to meet people where they're at in that moment and zoom out from your, in this case, we're talking about a small valve, but we are really talking about ensuring that person has the best possible outcome from that physical, mental, social, and spiritual perspective. And I think that is the essence of nursing in many ways. So it's interesting. Yeah. Having said that, then there's also the competing demands of, you know, X number of referrals and that pressure. And there is, I agree with you, there is a space for checklists, because checklists makes patients safer. Yeah. But the relational component of nursing practice on that telephone or in the clinic room is what defines us. And that is the magic dust that improves outcomes. I am absolutely convinced of that.
So In the work that you're describing, are there any conversations that you would label as difficult? Or, what would constitute a difficult conversation with a patient?
Yeah, and again, I'll preface it by saying that I am now more remote from direct patient care. I think when you're the difficult conversations, and I think this is the work that you and others have done, is kind of picking up the baton when nobody else has spoken to the patient about having a life-limiting disease. And I think that is well documented, whether it's in heart failure or renal failure or, COPD, et cetera. It's having lived exclusively in the hospital setting in terms of my clinical role, it just feels like we have not made a lot of progress in terms of equipping patients with a good understanding of what does it mean to have a life-limiting disease. It continues to sadden me how fractured that communication is. And, hospitals, for the most part, provide only episodic care along a continuum. And I feel like we're spinning our wheels still around that cohesive continuity of communication about what that means. So those difficult conversations, I think, continue to be, and this is, I think, frustrating to all of us, of realizing that the patient has never had a conversation, that the disease that they have could or will lead to increased burden of symptoms and ultimately to death. It feels like we should be further along this pathway.
Yes. Now.
And it just, yeah. I think the second thing that I'm reflecting on, and I guess I am not going to solve that one in my lifetime anymore. That is for others to continue. Mm-hmm. And we have so much evidence about what we ought to do and how that is still not happening. So that's my first point. My second point around the difficult conversations is, I think one thing that I'm particularly passionate is continuing to make this a core competency of nurses. It makes me sad when I hear in the ICU, oh, we'll have the social work speak to the family, or we'll just wait for the doctor. One of my difficult conversations as a leader of nursing practice is ensuring that nurses continue to be supported, educated, trained, and mentored in the conversation, but also that nurses continue to own it. And again, I feel like there's a thinning of that fabric as we move towards more kind of specialized and siloed disciplines in some ways. Mm-hmm. In my heart of hearts, I feel like as nursing leaders, we ought to continue to advocate for nurses to be at the core of that communication. No other discipline spends as much time with patients. No one sees patients at their most vulnerable state than nurses, where it's working on the streets with people, whether it's in a clinic room, in the emerge department, or in a room between that stretcher and that bed. I feel like as nurses, and this is, we need to continue to own that space, but importantly, to integrate it in all aspects of the work that we do. So to me, the difficult conversations, when I think of that in my current role, is with leadership to promote the role that nurses play when to have those conversations.
What an interesting comment. And it makes me think about, we're talking about relational work within an efficiency model. An efficiency model of care where we're just really trying to manage the volume of traffic because the need is so great and it does create a great complexity. In our next moments here, I'm wondering if we could maybe focus in a little bit more on the idea about shared decision making, because you've talked about it, you referred to it a couple of times, and I know that that's a big focus of your work. Wondering if you can define it. What is shared decision-making? I think many people misunderstand it, and or maybe don't really know what it is, and patients might never have heard of it. Who knows?
Yeah, you know, I think it's accidentally that I'm currently in this sandbox, and I think I've spoken about that journey I've made from kind of like innovation to understanding where patients are at and what they're hoping to gain from the procedure to developing, you know, patient education resources, supporting nurses in those difficult conversations. So there's a natural extension to that around trying to figure out how to help patients and families achieve a high quality decision. You know, I think you and I as nurses, we've been part of consenting patients and part of educating patients. And what I've learned, and I just really want to credit my colleague, Dr. Christina Lewis, over at University of Ottawa, who works with Don Stacey, and then my colleague Sandra Carroll as well, for having some of those conversations around the things that you're talking about are actually fit in this bucket of shared decision making. So I feel very much that people like Christina are mentoring me in this sphere. So I just want to say that about it's new learning for me. But to some degree, it's natural learning because it is this area that I'm in right now. And there are increasingly, there's a lot of choices to be made in cardiac care. And what I have seen, and with some of the data that I've seen, is depending on who the patient meets first, really dictates what their journey is going to look like. So there's some data that suggests that, for example, if you have heart valve disease and you meet a surgeon first, you're more likely to have surgery. If you have heart valve disease and you go to a cardiologist, or you are more sent into a kind of like this heart team setup, you're more likely to have, you know, maybe be offered a choice or a consideration of another therapy. So I'm really intrigued by this idea. Plus the conversation that we had of sometimes it is best to do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So shared decision-making is a framework, the way I see it. And again, I am not a scholar in this area. I feel like I'm, you know, not quite an imposter, but I'm dabbling. It is a framework to think about what does it take to ensure that patients are making a high treatment decision, a good quality treatment decision. So what I've learned, it's an exchange of information. It's first and foremost an opening of the door. That question that we asked 10 years ago, what matters most to you, to me fits within shared decision making. So tell me what matters most. Mm-hmm. And being invited and empowered into that decision. So then it's an exchange of information. But importantly, it is not just considering the clinician's expertise, it's also considering the patient's expertise in what matters most to them. So it's a coming together of those two levels of expertise to understand that the first and foremost is a decision to be made, that these are some of the options that are available, or there might be only one option. There's always an option to do nothing. So at a minimum, there's two options, or maybe just one option. These are some of the risk and benefits. And then what are then some of the patient's values, priorities, and preferences that allow the consideration of ultimately that treatment decision? So it's a culture shift from my perspective. It's not consent. It's not just patient education, but it is looking at the treatment decision as a joint decision where patients are empowered to be part of it. Now, having said that, I also think it's a pretty simple concept. Like, this is not rocket science. We're not talking about a many hours discussion here, but it is a spirit of engagement with patients that shifts the culture from clinician-driven to patient-centered, which is, I think, what we're trying to do, but also equips patients with the tools required to be part of that partnership.
And do you think, in your experience, do patients understand that that is a role that they should have, or that they should have tools, or do they look outside for that expertise? Or maybe it is up to us to be encouraging them to take on that, I guess.
From my perspective, this is not about putting more on patients. They've got enough to deal with. As I have described the symptoms of heart
Yes.
valve, it is hard enough to deal to live with heart valve disease or with cardiac disease or renal disease, etc. So I from my perspective, it's on us, us being the system, to support patients and to also importantly shift some of the culture of care. So I'm doing some interesting work with Global Heart Hub, which is a patient advocacy organization that really has at the center of their interests how to, again, equip patients to be part of this by providing some of these tools. Importantly, some of the work that we've done together has really shone a light on the need to train healthcare providers. Shared decision making is, you know, black on white in multiple international guidelines. Thou shall do shared decision making when you're deciding to do dialysis versus not dialysis, anticoagulants versus not. Thou shall do it. So, and we know that guidelines being, you know, at the pinnacle of evidence is what guides our practice in principle. But what we're also learning is exactly what you're alluding to, is that what we call shared decision making and what is actually happening, there's a gap. So it's a gap in translation. We are now, I think, moving away from understanding that it helps. We know that a patient who participates in shared decision making experiences lower levels of, you know, that anxiety that people have of, I wish I had known, or I think I made the wrong decision, or if only I had. Like, those things are, people live with those decisions for the rest of their lives, right? So we know it works, but what we don't know is how to implement it. And I think this is the sphere we're in right now, this whole need to, as a researcher and as a clinician, to study the implementation and to understand, you know, the barriers and how to really leverage the facilitators to do this. I had some conversations with my physician colleagues around this, and they go, well, Sandra, what if the patient makes the wrong decision? Like, that's moral distress for the physician, right? Like, what if? And conveying that shared decision-making is not picking items off a menu. It is a conversation that highlights what really matters to the patients, but also what is doable. So we're not losing that component as well. So I think we have a lot of work to do in this sphere, and I'm really excited to be partnering again with my colleague Christina Lewis on completing a research project that Heart and Stroke Foundation is supporting us in to look at the implementation of a tool for decision making, so patient decision aids, to facilitate that conversation. And and I'm a learner in this sphere, and but it's a good fit for some of the passion that I have for ensuring that we continue to work really hard to it, so that our patients have the kinds of outcomes that matter most to them.
Thank you, Sandra. If ever there was a radical idea, there you go. How strange that it should be radical, that we put patients at the center and we find ways to work to need what they work to offer and honor what they actually want. And it is challenging because we have so many amazing innovations in the world. We all do want the best for people, and how do we get there? You've offered us some wonderful insights and reflections, and we'll put up on our website some of the resources that you've referred to in case people want to look, including the, perhaps there's links to the Global Heart Hub, and wish you well in all this work. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the honor of speaking with you. I really enjoyed this, and I share your passion for putting forth what ought to be simple ideas, but continue to be kind of, as you said, radical ideas that will hopefully continue to contribute to shifting some of the way we do the work that we're doing. So thanks, Pat.
Thanks for listening. We're grateful to those of you who continue to follow and share this podcast on social media and help our audience grow. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at www.radicalnursetalk.com or by emailing us at radicalnursetalk@gmail.com. The producer-editor of this podcast is Jeremy Ramos Foley. Social media by Amy Strachan.